This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of December 10th, here are some top stories.
When someone dies, the physical items they leave behind can hold a kind of magic for their loved ones. Glasses, an old car, worn shoes. But what about something as intangible as a phone number? KJZZ's Stina Sieg brings us the story of how one cell phone number bonded three women, each grieving for the husband that she lost.
The story begins June 30th, 2013, when 19 wildland firefighters died fighting the Yarnell Hill Fire. And the story is still going now.
I know you too.
Hi, Debbie.
I'm Fernanda Santos. I'm 45.
My name's Debbie Mazzella, and I'm 49 years old.
I'm Krista Eckel, and I am 34, and I live in Paulden, Arizona.
And this is Krista's home, about 65 miles north of where her first husband, Travis, was overrun by flames, along with all but one of the Granite Mountain hotshots. The next morning, she had to tell her 6-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter their dad wasn't coming home.
That's probably the part that gets me the most to this day. I can talk about all of it. But as a mother, you do. You carry that burden more for your kids than you do yourself.
Everyone in this room knows that pain. When Debbie's first husband, Jay, died 15 years ago, she also had two children. She's now married to a firefighter in the same region. And he's the one who told her about the deaths of the Granite Mountain hotshots.
I'll never forget, I was on the side of my bed and I fell to my knees and I just started, you know, praying for the families.
Not long after, Fernanda became close with many of those families. Back then, she was a Phoenix-based writer for the New York Times. And people trusted her with their stories, which she poured into articles and then into a book.
And then my husband died. So Mike died November 1st, 2017.
Just a month after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Their daughter Flora was 8.
I felt like nobody, even the people who meant really well, didn't really understand.
Except there were some who did. The firefighters' families. Fernanda had kept in touch. And on a hot day this August, she was invited up to a barbecue in Prescott at one of their homes. That's when she finally met Krista, the hotshot widow, who'd mostly steered clear of media in the past.
And then we started talking.
About all kinds of things, including the financial reality of being widowed. Krista had canceled her late husband's cell phone, and Fernanda had too, but told Krista she was paying $5 a month to preserve the number so her daughter could use it someday.
And then you were like, what?
I know, I was shocked. I did not know you could do that.
If Krista had known, she would have saved her husband's number for their son, Braden, who was now 12 and begging for a phone. But it was 5 years too late. So she did the only thing she thought she could. She sent a text message to the number, asking if whoever had it would be willing to give it to her son. She posted about it on Facebook and waited. Debbie replied.
Perhaps it will be meaningful to your son to know that his dad's number was given to another firefighter's wife all this time and to someone who has prayed for God to mend and heal your broken hearts over these years.
That's a tiny portion of what Debbie wrote back. She's the widow from the beginning of the story who had felt so connected to the hotshot families.
I would gladly give up my number. Would you allow me a little time to make the arrangements with my carrier?
Now, a few months later, Krista says words can't describe the difference those few digits have made to her son.
Braden's so excited that he has that number. He's so proud to give it out. You know, that was my dad's old number. He says that to everybody he gives it to.
He has the number, and now Krista, Debbie, and Fernanda have one another, and their families, too.
She played peekaboo with you. So cute.
Fernanda holds Krista's smiley 10-month-old daughter, Cheyenne. This is actually the first time all three women have met in person, after connecting mostly through calling and texting. But they say they're going to stay in one another's lives. Debbie, who still cries over her first husband's death 15 years ago, leans in close to Fernanda.
Yeah. You know, you will survive this, and it doesn't feel like it all the time,
no.
You know?
But all three know it's true. They also know how important it is to keep the memories alive of the men they've lost. Friends and acquaintances will often avoid talking about their late husbands. Don't do that, these women say. Instead, say their names.
My late husband's name is Jay Manecki.
Mike Saucier.
Travis Carter.
Then in tears, they all embrace, each hugging a woman who understands.
It's okay. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being who you are. Mm-hmm. And you too.
Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Paulden.
From the business desk, here's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody.
Public pushback on a $230 million deal between Phoenix and the Suns led the city council to postpone a vote yesterday. Council members had planned to act on a deal to renovate Talking Stick Resort Arena, where the basketball team plays, but instead changed course. KJZZ's Christina Estes has been covering arena negotiations, and she joins me now. Hey, Christina.
Good morning, Mark.
So I know the Suns president talked to reporters immediately after the vote, but before we hear from him, tell us what the council ended up actually doing yesterday.
Well, rather than vote on the renovation deal, council members voted to post financial information online and hold five public meetings so residents can weigh in. Although city leaders have been talking with the Suns for about 3 years, negotiations have taken place behind closed door in executive session. The proposal became public less than a week before yesterday's scheduled vote. Concerns from residents about the timing and lack of details is what led Councilman Michael Nowakowski to request five meetings be held. So they will address the specific proposal as well as overall arena operations and its costs and benefits.
And those five public meetings should take place before January 23rd, because that's when the council expects to vote on the proposed deal, right?
Well, that's the latest plan, subject to change, of course. After the council pushed the renovation vote to January, Suns president and CEO Jason Rowley talked to reporters about negotiations for the very first time.
The reality is, up to this point, the Suns organization has put in about $150 million, and that is not counting taxes. That's not counting our operational costs. About $150 million we have put into it from construction, capital improvements, and so forth over the years. And the city's put in about $80 million.
The proposed deal would flip those numbers, with the city paying $150 million in initial costs and the Suns paying $80 million. It would also include a new fund for future renovations, with Phoenix kicking in $25 million over 12 and a half years, and the Suns contributing half, $12.5 million. I asked Rowley if the team would stay regardless of a deal.
Our commitment, 100%, is to stay in downtown Phoenix and to come to a resolution with that. The reality of the sports environment is that if we can't come to any kind of a conclusion or any kind of an agreement, we don't know what the future will hold. Our commitment is to work to stay here in downtown, and that is Robert's commitment.
Now, Christina, by Robert, he means Robert Sarver, the owner of the Suns.
Right.
And earlier this week, Arizona Republic columnist Lawyer Roberts wrote that Sarver had threatened to move the team if the deal didn't go through. What did the Suns president have to say about that?
Rowley said the team has made zero threats about moving to another city.
Is it a well-known fact that the city of Seattle is putting $700 million into Key Arena? It's a well-known fact. Is it a well-known fact that the city of Las Vegas is actively trying to attract a Major League Baseball team? They're actively trying to attract an NBA team, no question about it. But that is not coming from us. We are not making those threats. We are focused on this town, this city, downtown Phoenix, and getting our deal done.
So is he saying the Suns are not actively looking at other cities?
Well, not exactly those words. What he said was they don't need to focus on other cities because they're focusing on Phoenix right now. However, he added, quote, nobody would close the option.
So, Christina, what's the status then of the current deal between the Suns and the city? What kind of out does the team have?
The current deal has been in place for 26 years. It says if the building is deemed obsolete after 30 years, the Suns can leave downtown if no deal is reached. Rowley says the process to determine whether the arena, which is one of the oldest in the NBA, is obsolete, will begin next year. He says their preference is to stay downtown, and he's confident an agreement can be reached.
All right. We'll obviously be talking more next month during the public meetings and before the council votes. That's KJZZ's Christina Estes. Christina, as always, thank you.
You're very welcome.
The city council yesterday also voted down a proposed water rate increase, although Mayor Thelda Williams says she plans to bring the issue back before the council. The plan would have raised Phoenix's water rates by 6% in each of the next 2 years to pay for infrastructure upgrades. And joining us now to talk about that, as well as the Suns arena, is Claude Maddox of the firm Molera Alvarez. He's a former member of the Phoenix City Council and current chair of the city's Water and Wastewater Rate Advisory Committee. Claude, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. So I'm curious, as a former member of council, what do you make of what happened with the Suns arena deal? It seemed to sort of come together quickly and then fall apart very quickly.
Well, it's a tough vote. And I think that ultimately the decision to continue it, to make a community outreach, get more input, and then come back and make a informed decision, I think that's a good idea. So I support the decision that was made yesterday.
As a member of council, how seriously would you take the potential threat, either implied or actual, or even maybe just the idea that the Suns could potentially leave Arizona?
That is an option that they have. I think that one of the things that needs to be considered is how much impact does it have on the businesses and all of the investments that have been done in downtown.
So let's talk now about the water rate increase. And this seemed like maybe a less controversial. I know we're setting the bar kind of low on that, but it seemed like a less controversial deal than the Suns arena deal. From your understanding, what happened with that? Why did the council not vote to do that?
I can't answer the question as to why the council did not vote to do that, other than the comments that were made yesterday about raising taxes. Now, this is not a tax per se. It's a fee. Basically, we're talking about an enterprise fund that has to pay for itself. It doesn't come out of the general fund, which pays for police and parks and fire and all of those things. Basically, this is a department that has to generate its own revenue in order to pay its normal operating expenses. Plus, it has to pay for new infrastructure and to repair old infrastructure.
Claude, I want to ask you about the politics around some of this, both of these votes actually. I mean, how much do you think politics is coming into play here, especially with an interim mayor and an election coming up in a few weeks or a few months?
Well, obviously it's politics in both cases. I think that the interim mayor is trying to move some business forward that needs to be taken care of, especially in the water situation. Mayor Williams it represents the city of Phoenix on the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association. She has a great deal of background in water. She knows what the situation is, and she feels that this is important to get it done to address the needs of the future and to fix the infrastructure that has been delayed for a while. Let's put it that way.
What has to happen between now and whenever that issue comes back before council for supporters of it to change the outcome?
I think, first of all, they need to find out what the concerns are of some of the council members that voted no. And I think that the staff needs to explain better exactly what this does. There was a lot of public outreach on this. This is not a situation where this happened blindly behind closed doors. I, as the chairman of the committee that I represent, had at least 10 meetings that were public meetings. I know that staff, after the recommendation was made, had, I'm going to say, probably about 50 meetings with public to explain what was going on. I think that ultimately council is making a decision that we're going to kick this can down the road a little bit longer. We don't think it's necessary now. But the truth is that if we have a shortage on the Colorado River, which seems to be imminent, will we be able to respond to that in a timely manner that doesn't impact our economic well-being, doesn't impact our business community, doesn't impact the residents? I'm reminded, and perhaps you might remember, back in the 90s, Phoenix had a shortage and basically went on our drought plan.
Right.
We did not have to do a moratorium on development because we had planned properly. Whereas in Southern California, in Colorado, and other states around the Southwest, they actually did a moratorium. They would not install water meters on homes that were completed because of the fact that they didn't have the ability to provide the water. We never had to face that because we made good decisions and we planned for the future.
Right. Claude, I'm sorry to cut you off. We're unfortunately out of time, so I'm sorry to cut you off. But
that's okay.
Claude Maddox with the firm Molera Alvarez, former city council member, thank you very much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Good morning.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's something a little bit different. I came in like a wrecking ball. I never hit so hard in love. All I wanted was to break you up. That, of course, is the hit song Wrecking Ball, which swung Miley Cyrus into first place on the Billboard's Hot 100 chart in 2013. And now the song is crashing through the auction block. The song is listed on the website Royalty Exchange with just hours until close. So if you have an extra $36,000 or so lying around, you could own the rights to this song, or at least a part of the rights. Music journalist Sherry Hu says a lot of hit songs like Wrecking Ball have an increasing number of songwriters and producers on them, and they all own shares, essentially, in those songs. They can then sell their share on a platform like Royalty Exchange to make some cash. I spoke with Hu via Skype as the clock on Wrecking Ball ticked down, and I asked her who's actually buying the rights to these songs.
The range is quite big. I've met investors who are actually professional musicians, but they have some sort of investing background, or they've saved up some money and are interested in investing in other catalogs aside from their own. There are definitely more and more people from the traditional like finance and tech world that are investing in these catalogs, or at least participating in auctions, which I find really interesting. So yeah, it's a pretty wide range, and I think Royalty Exchange is benefiting from a recent new law that was passed that allowed companies to, I guess, raise money from non-traditional private investors as well, not just top accredited.
Interesting. Okay. So this has sort of opened it up to not, you know, the everyday music fan, but to somebody, you know, for example, who wants to own a piece of Wrecking Ball with $35,000.
Yes, exactly. Whereas previously, the only really viable way you would do that would be to work at a publishing company and then to buy maybe like all of Miley Cyrus's catalog. Like, I think the traditional way that like songwriting and publishing acquisitions happen is definitely in bulk. And this has caused debate in the music industry about whether it's actually a viable investment, is that the flexibility that a platform like Royalty Exchange provides means that you can auction off individual songs or like a smaller number of songs, which I think from a financial perspective is a little bit more difficult to predict in terms of how the songs will perform in the future. Whereas if you have like the entire, like Miley Cyrus's entire catalog, or I'm thinking of like the Beatles' entire catalog, projecting earnings from that, I think is just a much easier exercise.
Yeah, that's a safer bet. Okay. So can this be, if you invest in the right song, a lucrative world?
Yes, I think it could totally be a lucrative investment. And one interesting part of how Royalty Exchange works is that most of the investments are more or less passive. Like, as an artist, say that you're signed to a record label, or as a songwriter, you're assigned to a publisher, they have a controlling stake in the copyright, which means that they also have a vested interest in going out and making sure that the song is getting as many licenses or as much exposure as possible. So like the publisher will really proactively try to get that song placed in movies or TV, which is an increasingly lucrative revenue stream for a lot of songs, or like a label will just be really proactive in helping the song generate, you know, as many sales, as many streams as possible. Whereas most of the investors on Royalty Exchange, I think, are not actually active in the music industry, and they might not necessarily have the desire or the time to proactively vouch for the songs that they invest in, that they, right. they just want to have sort of a more passive income stream from some asset that is growing. Yeah, there have definitely been instances, especially in the streaming age, of a song that might not necessarily look like it's doing that well. It's like sort of tanking on the charts. It's not really generating enough activity, but then it gets placed in this blockbuster film, mm-hmm. Or it sort of surfaces again somehow, and then it has an entirely new life. And then because of streaming, people can stream it at any time, as many times as they want. And it just elongates the potential lifespan of a song, which I think people both inside and outside of the music industry are really excited about.
All right. Sherry Hu is a music and tech journalist who joined us to talk about royalty exchange. Sherry, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
From the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
Congress approved the Affordable Care Act more than 8 years ago, and it continues to be a political flashpoint, both here in Arizona and in Washington, D.C. The current open enrollment period ends on Friday, and in advance of that, we're looking at the issue of health care in a series of conversations. And speaking of the ACA, the health care law has been loved and loathed, but is it working? To get a sense of that, I'm joined by Swapna Reddy, a clinical assistant professor with the College of Health Solutions at ASU. And Swapna, is there an easy way to describe the state of the ACA in Arizona?
I think that the state of the Affordable Care Act in Arizona is actually, the best word would be surprising. I think that we were known as kind of ground zero for everything that was going wrong with the Affordable Care Act just 2 years ago. And what we're seeing this year is actually quite the turnaround and shift for consumers and for patients.
And part of that has to do with premiums, right, in terms of them not maybe being quite so high as they have been in the past?
Absolutely. So in 2014, when our insurance marketplaces began in Arizona, we actually had very low premiums. We had lots of insurers competing for consumers. By 2016-17, we had some of the highest premiums in the United States. And, you know, in 18, what's been fascinating is we've actually had some of the flattest premium increases. So it's actually been a very flat year from an increase perspective. And then most notably, and the surprising part, is that in 2019, we're actually seeing a pretty significant reduction in premiums, almost 10% in Arizona.
How much of that reduction has to do with the fact that they were so high and maybe they're just now coming down into line with maybe where they ought to be?
So the theory by, you know, the health economists and all us really exciting people that study this all the time is that in 2014, there were all these insurers competing and the prices were actually quite low. The premiums were really low. And in most cases, they were too low. And what we had was a state that was full of people that needed comprehensive care, that signed up and that used their insurance. But that ended up not being as profitable to a lot of the insurers as they expected or needed. And so they left. But I think what we're seeing right now and what it's being kind of described as is a righting of the market. So it's more in line with what it needed to be.
And are we also seeing more insurers coming back into the marketplace? I mean, as you described, there were counties where there was one or in some cases no choices for people who wanted to buy insurance on the marketplace.
Yeah, so that's another part of the surprising part of the story of Arizona is not only are we seeing a reduction in premiums for 2019, but we have two new insurers coming into Arizona and most notably Maricopa County. So I think that that not only reflects kind of a righting of the market and for premiums and for consumers, but also kind of a confidence from an insurer perspective that this is a great state to offer plans and to do business in.
What has changed? I mean, what is leading to these, you know, to this correction and to some of these surprises that you're talking about?
Well, you know, what's fascinating nationally is despite the fact that in 2016 with the national election, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, you know, was a major campaign slogan. And it was something that seemed to resonate with at least a significant portion of the American public. What I think has happened and what's really interesting are certain provisions of the Affordable Care Act are incredibly popular with the public. And I think that we've come to this place where we're not willing to go backwards on things like being discriminated against based on pre-existing conditions. That's really the big one, right? Things like being able to extend coverage for our adult children up to 26. I mean, these are really popular provisions. And I think despite all of the rhetoric, despite everything, we haven't seen a competing option that is providing comprehensive health care that protects us from being discriminated based on pre-existing conditions. And I think that speaks to kind of that resiliency of the Affordable Care Act and the need for that type of coverage.
With all that said, though, I mean, Congress still has sort of taken some shots at the ACA and repealed bits and pieces of it. How does that impact consumers, and how does that sort of impact the marketplace more broadly, both around the country and here in Arizona?
Yeah. So to your point, you know, last summer, most famously, the Congress, there were many bills in that attempted to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. But what we have seen is are kind of these incremental cuts to the Affordable Care Act, right? So, you know, there is no penalty for not complying with the individual mandate based on the tax plan. We have seen, you know, we're in an enrollment period right now until December 15th. It's the shortest enrollment period in six enrollment periods, 45 days shorter. There's been a 90% budget cut in advertising and in navigators to help people enroll in the Affordable Care Act. So what we're seeing is kind of this incremental disenabling of the Affordable Care Act. And I think that at the end of the day, that's incredibly dangerous for consumers. It's dangerous for people that need comprehensive health insurance.
Is there a sense of how consumers are trying to consume all of this information about the ACA, whether or not it's actually been repealed and replaced with something, if Obamacare is still on the books, how that affects the kinds of plans that they can get?
So I think that that's part of the danger of the climate that we're in right now, which is we know that consumers need comprehensive health insurance coverage. They're demonstrating that to us themselves. What's happened, though, is because of all of the changes, there's a lot of information, misinformation, and actual lack of confidence. So what we have seen in the first 4 weeks of enrollment this time is a significant decrease from this time last year. And I think a lot of that has to do with information, education, and confidence in the law.
So you don't see that necessarily as people maybe not wanting or not needing insurance. It's other factors.
Yeah, I think people still need insurance. And I think that they need not only insurance, but they need this comprehensive health insurance. And I think we saw that in the midterms. People felt really strongly about protecting pre-existing conditions. And so fascinating that that ended up being something that both parties actually claimed to feel very strongly about protecting, right? Because that's kind of the winds that have shifted in that direction from the public's perspective. So I think people definitely need insurance. I think that it's a lack of information about what's available to them right now.
At the risk of asking you a political science question, I'm curious if you were surprised, to your point, of how much of a talking point healthcare became in so many races, especially here in Arizona with the U.S. Senate race, and what that maybe tells us about the future of the ACA and what people want out of a healthcare law, be it the ACA or something else.
Yeah, if the question is, was I surprised? I was surprised. I was not surprised that it was a major talking point in the election and in the midterms. It was apparently the most important issue for voters. Healthcare was the most important issue for voters in the 2018 midterms. What was surprising to me was the laser focus on pre-existing conditions by both parties. And I think that both parties have recognized and realized that in order to win elections, in order to present yourself as a candidate that's friendly towards the healthcare needs of the public, you cannot be okay with discriminating based on pre-existing conditions. And if nothing else, I think that's one of the kind of most significant legacies of the Affordable Care Act is a national conversation on this topic that I don't even think people thought about prior to 2010.
If I might ask you to look into your crystal ball for a moment, given what we know about the incoming Congress, the Democrats will control the House, Republicans will still control the Senate. Of course, President Trump's still in office. Do you have a sense of what the future holds for the ACA in terms of any potential changes or maybe not changes?
It's, of course, really hard to say, and my crystal ball is not that shiny, so I'm not sure.
We'll use that stipulation.
Yes, yes. So we had to mention that. But I do think that, you know, look, with the political distribution now in the House, I think probably we won't see any major changes to the Affordable Care Act, especially in terms of a repeal or replace. And then, you know, where we're at in 2020, I think it'll be fascinating because, again, I don't think anybody would have predicted healthcare and especially pre-existing conditions to be such a driver in the midterms, and it certainly was in these House races. So I think that will only become magnified by 2020.
All right. That's Swapna Reddy, clinical assistant professor at ASU's College of Health Solutions. Swapna, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk.
Mexico's energy reforms have opened up a new market for gas stations owned by private companies. But the new president of the country has opposed those changes. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Mexico, Kendall Blust reports on the outlook for energy reform under the new Mexican administration.
A pink and blue clad gas station attendant fills a customer's tank at Rendy Chica's. It's one of a growing number of new gas station franchises cropping up in Hermosillo and across Mexico in recent years. This burgeoning market for privately owned gas stations stems from Mexico's 2013 Energy Reform Act. It opened up the state-run energy sector to private and foreign investment.
And so, you know, we've moved from being an entirely closed system to being one that is one of the most open in the world and really one of the most competitive in the world.
That's Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute, a think tank out of Washington, D.C. Before the reforms, Mexico's national petroleum company, Petróleos Mexicanos, or Pemex, held a monopoly on oil exploration and production, he says.
Now we see competition on the streets of Mexico between different brands.
Among other things, that means drivers don't have to fill up their tanks at the once ubiquitous green Pemex stations. Instead, they have a growing number of options. Shell, Arco, Chevron, one of the bright orange 76 stations that opened earlier this year, or a pink and purple Rendy Chicas. It's a Mexican-owned company that's trying to set itself apart from the competition. It touts a specially formulated fuel that it claims lasts longer than other gas and a catchy radio jingle. But most famously, the company stands out by marketing that it hires mostly women as fuel attendants or despachadoras at its dozens of stations in northern Mexico.
It is an image associated with honesty, the feminine image.
Patricia Sarawi is a Rendy Chicas spokeswoman. Rendy Chicas has adopted a very different approach to draw customers. Sarawi says in Mexico, gas stations have a reputation for cheating customers, so Rendy Chicas hired more women to soften the company's image, claiming women are perceived as more trustworthy. She says it set the company apart and allowed it to thrive even as competition heats up in the Mexican fuel market.
All
of that together, well, you can find it anywhere else.
But Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, has long been a critic of the Energy Reform Act. During his recent inauguration, he said reforms have caused a drop in oil production and increased gas prices. Here's Wood again.
So I think what we're seeing is that we're seeing a closing up of the system again.
There's still a lot of uncertainty about the future of reforms under this administration, he says. AMLO's promised not to rescind existing oil contracts, but has halted new bidding auctions, Wood says. And it's likely the new government will try to shore up Pemex by increasing regulations on private investors. Wood calls that bad news for the energy sector. But AMLO supporters say it's the policies of previous leaders that have been bad for Mexico. Jacobo Mendoza is president of the Sonoran branch of AMLO's Morena party.
We have no way of gathering wealth because we've been stripped out of our goods and resources, and the final bitter pill was the sale of our petroleum and gas.
But companies like Windstar, which opened two new gas stations in Hermosillo in December, aren't too worried, says the company's general counsel, Reynold Gonzalez.
I think the need for refined products in Mexico continues to grow on a daily basis. And so our plans don't change.
He says he doesn't think AMLO is set to suddenly put the brakes on energy reforms, and his Texas-based company plans to continue aggressively investing in Mexico. Sarawi of Rendy Chicas agrees. People like having more options at the pumps, and business is booming, she says.
And the truth is, we would like to see more and more clients at Rendy Chicas.
She doesn't think anything will get in the way of that right now. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
And finally, from the Education Desk. From KJZZ's The Show, here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
The ongoing shortage of family doctors in this country. Believe it or not, this is also about cost. More medical students today are going into more lucrative specialties instead of pursuing the much-needed general practitioner route. And now, new research from the USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy explores the why behind this shortage, and they do that by looking at Medicare. In this study, Dr. Paul Ginsberg and others look at the way that Medicare pays for services and subsidizes medical students' graduate education, and they find there's definitely dollars and cents behind this. I spoke with Ginsburg Moore about it via Skype, and I began by asking him to explain how Medicare helps pay for some medical students' schooling.
Well, actually, yes, Medicare has important programs that pay for graduate medical education. This is the stage of medical students' careers when they've graduated medical school and they're doing residency programs. So that's where the support comes in. And the notion behind it, which has gone on for decades, is that, you know, students, residents provide services as well as getting trained, and Medicare should be paying its share of what it gets as far as services from these residents.
So how does this end up affecting which specialties that medical students often choose?
Some people have looked to making changes in Medicare's way of financing graduate medical education as a way of addressing the primary care specialty mix. But in our study, we looked at how the different Medicare incentives that we could contemplate were actually overwhelmed by the incentives from the distorted payment system that teaching hospitals are responding to. To put it in more concrete terms, Medicare can pay more to train family physicians, but it's so much more lucrative for teaching programs to be training surgeons that they're probably not going to change very much if Medicare changes its way of funding graduate medical education.
Okay, so describe for us that distorted payment system you're talking about here.
Medicare developed a fee schedule, which it implemented in 1992, that determines the relative value for different services. And not only does Medicare pay this way, but commercial insurers and Medicaid programs have all adopted the Medicare relative value scale. So if Medicare is paying too little for services such as evaluation and management, that is very discouraging on new medical students and residents to be choosing primary care and other specialties, which are mostly based on visits rather than doing procedures.
So walk me through what happens as a result of that then. What is the next step?
Well, you know, what happens is that the, the incomes in specialties such as radiology and dermatology and a number of surgical specialties is much higher than incomes for primary care, you know, family physicians, pediatricians, general internists or psychiatrists. And this really affects choices that students make. No surprise.
Yeah. So we know that we have a shortage of general practitioners in medical care here in America. And you say that this is contributing to that shortage, which makes a lot of sense. How much is it affecting it? Can you measure it?
Well, I would say that the payment system probably explains most of it. There are some other factors now that, some young physicians are looking for, family-friendly specialties where they don't go on call and they have regular hours. Maybe they can work part-time. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I think the differences in income are very important. I mean, of course, there's the students' natural interests, but the payment system is a major impediment to getting the specialty mix right.
That makes sense because debt for medical students is probably also pretty overwhelming.
That's right. Actually, students these days probably have less flexibility to pursue what they'd really like to do because many of them have so much debt. In contrast to if you go back, 10 or 20 years ago, where debt was a smaller factor.
Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend? What would you like to see happen to help encourage students to become general practitioners or to shift the way that this payment system works to begin with?
Well, I think that the most important thing, which, many policy thinkers have been calling for some time, but it hasn't happened, is to try to revamp the way that Medicare pays for services. But barring that, you can try to change the way graduate medical education is paid for, or use the Medicare program. Use the funds that might have gone to graduate medical education and use it instead to provide incentives such as loan forgiveness to medical students and residents that choose primary care careers as long as they stay in them for a set period of time.
Yeah. Are there any efforts out there like that at this point, or does this work differently maybe in another country where you see different results?
Well, you know, in other countries, it's very different because in other countries, students don't pay anything for medical training, and governments play a role in deciding how many slots they will fund in different specialties.
What kind of results are we seeing in the country as a result of this shortage of general practitioners? I mean, are we starting to see too many of them retire? Are we starting to see a gap in medical care in that way?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. We do know that a system that's as imbalanced as ours towards procedural specialties is always a more expensive system. That's what some research has shown. And I think that's what we see. You know, the inability to find a primary care physician, that hasn't really seemed to have been a problem so far. And part of that is that there's been very rapid growth in nurse practitioners and physician assistants who, in a sense, have been able to augment the physician workforce. But you see problems down the road because a fairly high percentage of nurse practitioners and physician assistants are doing specialty care, working in specialty practices. So this may not be a long-term solution.
Paul Ginsberg is the director of the USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy, whose latest research looks at the connection between Medicare's payment system and our nation's shortage of general practitioners.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.